Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jeff Kiefer. My attorney number is 28056. I'm the attorney for the appellants Anthony and Pamela Janicek. If I could reserve 4 minutes of my time, I'd appreciate it. Your Honors, this case is about two things. One is the waiver of the homestead enormous statute, as I call it, 38-38-212. The other issue today is the failure of the lender to properly redeem its position in foreclosure. There's only three facts as I see it relevant for each issue. For the waiver, the Janiceks moved to Colorado and received a loan from their employer, the Snavelys. When negotiating over a second deed of trust that was to secure the loan, Mr. Janicek specifically objected to the draft in the deed of trust that contained a waiver of the homestead exemption. He told Snavely's attorney that he objected and he wanted to retain as many rights as possible regarding the homestead exemption.
Counsel, are you contending that there's something ambiguous in the deed of trust?
No.
Then why do we get into parole evidence about what the negotiations were?
As set forth in my brief, we talk about the intent of the parties. And the intent of the parties here, as I see it, was that the Janiceks clearly wanted to be ahead of Snavely regarding their deed of trust, regarding the home.
Normally we don't get into, we always look at the party's intent by looking at their agreement.
Correct.
So what, if the agreement is not ambiguous, why do we go into what they may have been thinking or talking to each other about?
Well, to me, that deed of trust waived the enormous statute. And talking about waiver, we talk about the contracts, and the statute was indeed waived. And that's why we
found. And where in the agreement was it waived?
That's when we started back to look at the negotiations. Originally, there was the homestead exemption that was being waived. The Janicek said, no, I want as many rights as possible, told the attorney, they redrafted it, took out the section that said homestead exemption. It was intentionally omitted. So that's where the waiver comes into play.
Well, if we just look at the four corners of the agreement,
yes.
You're pointing to, I think it's paragraph 22, which says
23.
Waiver of exemption purposely omitted.
Correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Kiefer, would you agree that the waiver of exemption refers to the deed of trust that was being negotiated?
The waiver of the exemption, yes. For the second deed of trust, the way I see it is that originally it was proposed that Snavely was the Janiceks were waiving their deed of trust, waiving their homestead exemption to the Snavelys, but then they said no. And so vis-a-vis the second deed of trust, yes. I agree that the first deed of trust, there was a waiver. Does that answer your question? And so now the statute was waived. That's our position, is that 38-38-212 was waived.
Nothing in the agreement refers to that statute, right?
It does not, correct. And there's nothing else in the record to indicate otherwise. The only facts that we have were two pages. One was the draft deed of trust. One was the final deed of trust. I guess there's an affidavit from my client and his testimony at the hearing. No contradicting testimony whatsoever. Mr. Janicek was clear. I wanted to keep all rights possible. He told Mr. Semler who drafted the document. Mr. Semler changed the document to reflect that intent, put it in the document. That's where the waiver comes into play.
Based on this testimony and the drafts, but not based on the contract itself.
I mean, the contract says, it says waiver is intentionally omitted. That to me says there is a dialogue, there is a give and take. It was specifically negotiated, and the parties agree that it was specifically negotiated. If there was nothing in the deed of trust about the homestead, we wouldn't be here. The fact is it was specifically negotiated. If there wasn't negotiations, there wouldn't have been a waiver. And that's why I think we're here, because of that specific negotiation. All of the cases that are in the briefs that talk about other parties, those were all judgment creditors who took the homeowner as they found him. And that's not the case here. The Frank case and all that line of cases have judgment creditors trying to buy the home or foreclose on the home and the homeowner wanting their homestead. This is not that case. The Janicek specifically negotiated to keep their homestead. This is the first case that I'm aware of where this has happened, and that's why we're here.
What is it that the Janiceks want? When all is said and done, what is it they want out of the case?
There's two things, obviously. No, I guess not obviously. One is that they should have been paid their homestead exemption when the redemption happened. Secondly, and that goes to the redemption portion that we'll talk about later, is that even if that portion fails, the overbid, there's approximately $25,000 of an overbid, since the lender failed to properly redeem, that overbid should have been distributed to them. So the first point would be the Janus X are entitled to the entire homestead exemption, $60,000, because the lender could not redeem unless they complied with the $60,000. Or if the court doesn't find that, then we've got the redemption statute that was not followed. And so in that case, with the redemption statute not being followed, the overbid is distributed by statute. And by statute and by the agreement, the Janus X are next in line.
Why isn't this all moot then, since the foreclosure went through, the redemption was completed? I agree, I understand your objections to it, but that all was done. The trial court, the monies were dispersed by the public trustee, that's already gone. So why isn't that moot?
Well, the money can fix the problem. The lender.
So what you're asking for is money.
Correct, that's all we can ask for.
From?
The lender. They receive the property.
From the lender.
Correct. Obsidio or Forestall's successor in interest.
Okay.
They receive the property. They sold the property. They receive the overbid. So if not 60 of the homestead exemption, and then 25 of the overbid, I believe, should be ordered to be returned to them.
Okay.
That's my... So, this other question about the waiver is a knowing waiver of the statute. The lender was represented by counsel. There's nothing in the record that shows that there's anything other than a clear, unequivocal waiver. This isn't a statute that can't be waived. The homestead is in the Constitution. Waiving the homestead is allowed. Waiving the annulment statute is also allowed. It's clear that it's waived. What they're trying to do is an end.
Why is it clear that it's waived, since there's no reference to that statute in the agreement?
The only thing we have in the record is the testimony of Mr. Janicek, where he says, when he points at the draft, he said, whatever rights I have about the homestead, I want. He didn't equivocate. He was very clear. He wanted everything. And in response to that, that's what happened. I don't know how he could have kept his homestead any clearer.
He could have written a provision that says, assuming that it would be permissible, that the Snavely hereby waives any rights it may have under the statute. I can't remember the specific citation. 212 sub 1. They didn't do that. They said purposely omitted.
Anyone who reads that document, would stop and say, well, wait a minute, something's happened here. It was there originally. That seems to be clear. Something was there, and now it's purposely omitted. So if I were someone else, I would read that and say, well, what was there? Why was this purposely omitted? If there's nothing in the record about the homestead, that's one thing. But there was language that says, basically, we discussed this, and I'm taking it out specifically. He said, I suppose you could have said, hereby waives 212, but you know, Mr. Janicek was represented, the Snavely's had counsel, and that's what came out of this.
Mr. Kiefer, even if we were to assume that this was applicable to the statute, and the waiver language was applicable to the statute, wouldn't it only come into play if there was a foreclosure under the second deed of trust?
And that's where I was just leading there, Your Honor. What they're trying to do is form over substance. We have a big picture. The big picture is the second deed of trust holder waived their rights to the exemption. They now have the property and haven't paid the exemption. Form over substance arguments don't work at any statutory construction. The IRS deals with this daily. They don't allow that. They look at the big picture. What they're trying to say is, well, geez, we didn't foreclose, but since we're going to redeem, we get to keep the homestead. I don't think that's an appropriate response. I think that's where estoppel comes into play, the waiver and estoppel together. You know, it appears to me that they are stopped from arguing that they now have rights to the homestead because they waived it in the document. you get either equitable estoppel or judicial estoppel. It seems to me that they're taking contradictory positions. In the document, they tell the Janicek, sure, you can keep your homestead. But when it comes to the foreclosure, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you my foreclosure. Oh, I'm sorry, not give you the homestead because I want this route. The formal of the substance doesn't work for me, Your Honor. I think the estoppel should not allow that sort of end run around the clear intent of the parties.
Let's assume, Mr. Kiefer, that some other lienor, a junior lienor to the state of the second deed of trust, redeemed.
Yes.
The state deed didn't redeem, and the third lien holder did.
Yes.
What would be your position about that third lien holder's right to the overage vis-a-vis your client?
Well, luckily we're not here on that, but I did think about that, Your Honor. And as I see it, the homestead exemption is first in line. It automatically attaches. Prior, you had to file something. It automatically attaches. In the first deed of trust, the Janicek is allowed to drop down to second. And they believe they're ahead of the Snavely's. Now, let's say they had a lawsuit or something else, and there was a third, a junior lien holder. I don't believe it's the homeowner's responsibility to clean that up. They specifically negotiated the first. They had control over it. They negotiated the second. They kept their homestead. If they fail to satisfy a judgment, you know, unfortunately, the statute says the third lien holder is allowed to proceed.
If the statute also says the third lien holder takes three of any homestead claim,
the third we are pursuing through the statute. Now you certainly want
to. The only difference here is we've got Snavely in the position of having a deed of trust that says there is no waiver of homestead rights.
Yes, if they specifically allow the JSX to keep it.
Why does it matter then that it's Snavely redeeming as opposed to the third lien holder I'm talking about? Seems like a totally inconsistent
truth. Well, there's nothing, we're assuming there's a judgment, I guess, for a junior lien holder. If there was a deed of trust, if there was a third deed of trust, well, then certainly the Snavely's would be responsible to negotiate protecting their homestead vis-a-vis that third lien holder, if they had the ability to. If there was a judgment and they couldn't do it, well, then it's their responsibility to keep that junior lien holder off the record of the property so they can protect their interest. And if they fail to protect their interest, so be it. But they've done everything that they could, in this case, to protect their interest. There's only two lien holders, the first and second. Now, if there was a third lien holder, I can certainly argue that it would be unconstitutional to allow someone not to ever keep their homestead, but we're not here for that argument. But the Janicek did what they could. They certainly tried to keep their homestead. They specifically negotiated. There were no third lien holders. At the end of the day, despite what the document says, the second deed of trust holder has the property and has the money. We can talk about redemption for, I guess, 2 minutes. The redemption statute is strict. The case law is very clear. You must follow it step by step. It is uncontroverted that the problem here was because the lender received the payoff in time. The lender chose to wait until the very last day of redemption to send their check.
Excuse me.
Yes, John.
I want to make sure I understand the argument. Is this argument totally independent of your argument on the homestead exemption?
Yes, sure.
So that if we were to rule against you on your first argument, homestead exemption, you would still contend that your clients are entitled to the overbid?
Yes, because if the lender is entitled to redeem the overbid, well, I'm sorry, the lender failed to properly redeem, is my position. So if they don't have to pay the $60,000 for the homestead, when there was an overbid, that overbid needs to be distributed to the right parties. In this case, they poorly redeemed, so there is no overbid. My position is that they failed to redeem, and therefore they're out of the picture.
So why wouldn't they go? I mean, if they fail to redeem, just assume they decide they didn't want to redeem.
Correct.
If they've already served their notice, but at the last minute they decide they don't want to redeem, under the statute, aren't they entitled to receive the excess proceeds?
No, because they waive the rights to the homestead. The homestead comes above them.
No, I'm saying independent of your argument about waiver.
No, the case law cited in my brief says the homestead comes ahead of the second. And so if there was a waiver in that second, you're right, they would get the money regardless. But because there was a waiver, the overbid goes to the Janicek because the redemption is improper. They didn't redeem properly, they failed, there's no, there's somebody else's fault other than the lender. So because of the ordering statute, my client gets the overbid. I've got 5 seconds, so I will conclude with thank you for hearing me, and I'll see you in the future.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Brad March. I'm here representing the appellees Obsidio and Forrestal. The primary reason we asked for oral argument in this matter was simply to stress the fact that Mr. Kiefer had indicated in his brief that having not addressed the waiver issue, or we somehow had acknowledged that Section 212 could be waived. That clearly is not our position. We've argued that all the way through the trial court. We've argued that in our briefs. We do not agree that that can be waived, notwithstanding the statements in his reply.
Your argument is that even if you had agreed to do it, it was not, you could not waive it.
Yeah, I don't know, but that's not the issue. I mean, perhaps there, and that's an interesting issue that probably is where I'm going, Judge Miller, is that we're a bona fide purchaser. We bought this note. We had no idea about what the negotiations were that occurred with the original holder of the second and the second deed of trust. Relative, there clearly is not a homestead exemption. We acknowledge that in court. It's been stricken. You've recited the paragraph that it was straight, that it references that it was intentionally admitted. But there's nothing related to 212. We weren't involved in the negotiations. One of the things that the uniform credit, we're entitled to buy notes. We bought the note, we received the deed of trust. We bought it for purposes of redemption. We relied on that. We had no idea what the negotiations were. I question whether anybody addressed 212 in those negotiations, but I don't know. Could you waive it? Perhaps. As you said, perhaps if you had specific language that said 212 is intended to be waived and the redeemer has to pay a homestead exemption, perhaps it's waived. I don't know if that works, and that's a question for this court for another day, perhaps. But in this case, we are a bona fide purchaser. We bought this note. We bought it for the specific purposes of redeeming. We intended to redeem. We relied upon the statute. Not only did we rely on the statute, we relied on the public trustee's interpretation, and we relied upon the court's interpretation. As you pointed out, this case has gotten to the point that there's not just an element of mootness. Putting this bullet back in the gun would be extremely difficult. The proceeds have been distributed. The property has been conveyed. No bond was posted as part of this appeal. Our clients...
Why couldn't your clients pay him the $24,000?
We could pay him $60,000. Again, I suppose we could pay a lot of money. I don't think it's due, Your Honor. Putting it back together, and I guess perhaps that begs the question, maybe that doesn't make it moot. I suppose that we could pay the $24,000, but in reliance on what the court did, in reliance on the lower court, in reliance on what the actions of the public trustee, in conjunction also with the issues or the concerns that have been raised relative to the redemption, our client received the property with a $316,000 loan against it. And I quickly did the math. That's 511 days from the date of redemption till today, if we hadn't sold it. At 6% interest, that'd be $26,000 worth of interest for holding costs that have been out there. That well exceeds that overbid. We made decisions based upon what the court did. We made decisions based upon what the public trustee did. And most importantly, decisions were made by the court and the public trustee based upon the reliability of the statute. That's why the statute exists. The statute came out of, clearly, and I tried to include the legislative history. The legislative history in this matter is great. If you look at it, it follows the Frank case. Judge Tursi is one of my favorite judges. He felt there was a homestead allowance that should apply in conjunction with a redemption. When the public trustees, others, and the state archives are clear that when this was done, following the Frank case, There was a bill that was amended, 1546, that was introduced, 1546, that originally amended Section 206, which affords homestead exemptions, 41206. It came back and it amended Section 206. It said, you do not get to rely on a homestead exemption if it's a redemption circumstance. That bill was then changed. It was re-engrossed, I think it was in April, and again, the materials should be in there. It was re-engrossed. Having been re-engrossed, they changed it, and the legislature discussed the possibility of saying, you ought to get, as Judge Tersey had felt in the Frank case, you ought to receive your homestead rights when you redeem. The legislature did not adopt that. They did not take that position specifically, and they instead adopted 212, a specific statute that dealt independently with the problem. It set it aside from 206. In Section 1, it deals with, as I recall, I may get these backwards, it deals with if your first does not have a waiver, in the second, if it does have a waiver, maybe the other way around. But clearly, and the trial court recognized this, Mr. Kiefer's position was there are no annotations, therefore it's not clear. This has been in place 30 years. There's no annotations because it's clear.
You're not contending that the statute is ambiguous.
Absolutely not. Nor did the trial court find that. If you look at it, look at the record at 315 and 316, I think the pages are. And the trial court said, I can't ignore this statute. The homestead allowances allowed by the Constitution says that what's supposed to occur is the legislature is supposed to adopt liberal homestead laws. Mr. Kiefer doesn't challenge the fact that these are unconstitutional. The legislature has adopted liberal homestead laws, and this is what they do. The statute is clear. You have an ability to redeem from a deed of trust. If that deed of trust has a waiver, that the redeemer gets advantage. They don't have to fund this. I mean, it's that simple. The court came back and said it is very clear that a junior lien or redeeming acquires the property free of the homestead rule, right. This, I would suggest, is not a question of interpreting the statute. It's just a question of reading the statute. I mean, it that's what it says. That's what the lower court said it said. The other thing that the court recognized, or the other thing that the legislative history recognized, there's some notes. I get a blow up of it. They're attached to my brief. It looks something like this. It's just a handwritten note from the Public Trustees Association. And the Public Trustees Association came back and, in conjunction with support of 1546 and the way it was ultimately adopted, they said, look, we've got to have clarity. We've got to be in a position where we have a mechanized procedure. They specifically addressed the fact. We need this bill introduced because of Frank. They say, we're making quasi-judicial decisions. We as public trustees, we're not comfortable doing that. They say, we are having inconsistent responses as a result of different interpretations by different public trustees. And the response to that is they're saying, we have to have this mechanism that tells us how to manage these. That mechanism has been in place for almost 30 years, 1983. It was brought up, you know, what do you do? What I understand Mr. Kiefer's position to be is that if there is a waiver, somehow there's got to be an understanding that we waive this. And so basically what he's asking the public trustee to do is somehow come back outside the four corners of the document, as Judge Miller points out, and determine, maybe with a crystal ball, that somehow this was waived in this case and it wasn't waived in this case and this was the party's intent. You're going to clog the courts, absolutely, with trying to figure out what this means. I don't know how that can be managed if you accept his interpretation. Let me talk briefly, if I could, about the issues related to the redemption and the actual payment of redemption. I'm not sure Mr. Kiefer has standing. I disagree with his position, and we said this in our brief, so perhaps I'm reiterating. But if you look at Section 3838.111, I think that statute is very clear that you pay junior lienors. It doesn't go that after you've paid the lienors, then it goes to his client. But the redemption, the overbid would have gone to our client. At that point, we're at some sort of a point, we have an issue that it's no harm, no foul. I mean, we would have gotten the money. Tucker would have gotten the ground. He would have been in the exact same position he was in. The party purchasing would have bought it. The reason that this happened the way it did in part was because the Tuckers didn't want the ground anymore. They didn't. The original bidders at the sale did not want that property. And so the public trustee came back and said, look, we'll accept the shortfall bid. We'll make that happen. That was then blessed by the court. I don't know how else you would have fixed that. I don't know how to undo it at this point based upon the failure of the redemption. I mean, and certainly the money under the statute would not go back to the Janacheks. I'll give Mr. Simler the last word.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Parker Semler, and I represent the Snavely Development Company. The primary purpose of Snavely is before the court is to actually argue that attorney's fees should have been granted in this case, and I have 3 points that I'd like to stress. Snavely should never have been a party to this lawsuit. There were two deeds of trust. The first deed of trust contained a waiver of the homestead. 3841212 basically says you follow form. This is not a case regarding anything, any valid argument regarding waiver. If the first deed of trust contains the waiver of the homestead exemption, this is merely a redemption case. Mr. Kiefer and the Janacheks try to turn it into something that it is not. Perhaps the Janacheks have an argument on the issue of what took place within the public trustee's office, but that isn't Snavely's issue. Snavely should never have been named as a party to this lawsuit. Snavely sent a detailed message, which is CD 156 through 161, prior to the initiation of this lawsuit. That is in the record. It spells out in detail 3841-212, the Frank versus First National Bank, Judge Tursi's dissent, and if the Janacheks wanted to explore it, Mr. Marsh explained in detail the legislative history justifying why that statute exists. If that memo and the law set forth in that memo had been properly absorbed, there is no good faith basis for the Janacheks to have brought the Snavelys into this lawsuit. Once they were in the lawsuit, there was a continuation of the groundless and frivolous actions on the part of the Janacheks. CD page 37, there's a June 18th memo. It's a motion to reduce bond, and the Janacheks informed the court that the Snavelys have assigned the deed of trust. They're not in it anymore. The Janacheks have since argued somehow that the Snavelys were remained in the lawsuit of their own volition. Yet a week later, the Snavelys were subject to a renewed and expedited motion for TRO on June 25th, 2010, and were subject to a specific order to show cause drafted by the Janacheks that they are forced to remain in the case. Now, they've already acknowledged a week earlier they have no basis in the case. The Janacheks made no effort to dismiss the Snavelys pursuant to their obligations under CRS 13171025, which basically says when you realize someone shouldn't be in a case, you've got to cut them loose. You've got to let them go. So not only were the Snavelys should never have been in the case to begin with, they should have been cut loose once they were recognized that an assignment had occurred. It's the Snavely's position that the trust...
Excuse me, counsel. What relief did the plaintiff seek against the Snavely's?
The relief was in two forms. One, a temporary restraining order, and two, an order to show cause to come forward and explain why the homestead shouldn't apply. So Snavely's were essentially compelled to come to stay in the proceeding and come forward and explain the issue of the homestead. Those were the two orders that were...
What relief was being sought against Snavely? I mean, supposing Snavely just didn't show up anything, what could have happened to Snavely? Were they asking for any monetary relief? Were they asking for injunctive relief against Snavely?
They were asking for injunctive relief at that
against point. Snavely?
Against Snavely, yes, sir.
To enjoining you from doing what?
Enjoining Snavely... I'm sorry, I stand corrected. The injunctive relief was to enjoin the public trustee from going forward with any further distribution of the funds. So that was the injunctive relief. So I misspoke. The order to show cause was to compel the Snavelys to come forward, remain in the litigation, and explain why the Janusecs shouldn't prevail on their homestead argument.
Why couldn't the Snavely just have said, we don't take any position on this?
The Snavelys could have maintained that position, but at that point, they were, had already been brought into a litigation that they felt was wrongful and had, as set forth in our papers, at that point where we were going to be, we were going to seek fees. But the, at, but we were subject to a court order ordering us to be there. It was an order to show cause. This wasn't the Snavely's choice to be there or not be there. The court ordered us to come forward and make our and argue our positions. With respect to the court's failure to award attorney's fees, this court has de novo review to take a look at the analysis. I'm out of time, Your Honor. The analysis also relies upon the waiver argument, which we think is misplaced. We think Snavely should be awarded their attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, all counsel. I'm not sure if you have any time left.
When I reserved four, that wasn't on the clock?
The response counts whether you reserved.
I thought it's already at 11.
Fair enough, Your Honor. In any event, the case will get involved in the written opinion in due course. We thank you for your arguments this morning.